Yoga is the science of realization. It posits the idea that within our potentiality resides a higher consciousness, something that is beyond the mind, beyond reasoning, beyond the senses, five senses, how we're normally informed about this world. And that through quieting the mind in the way that we just were practicing by watching the breath, it's been compared to a body of water. And when the wind is blowing across it, it creates a very choppy kind of water, doesn't it? And that's the restlessness of the mind, the restlessness of the breath. When you calm the breath, the winds die down, the water begins to get flat, like a mirror. And then it reflects the mountains, the stars, the moon, the sun, all up in the sky. Similarly, the mind becomes very still and begins to reflect the higher virtues, the supreme consciousness. And through that, you discover who you really are in a very deep and profound kind of a way. And so the ancient practitioners of yoga developed these methods of watching the breath and other kinds of methods such as this in order to still the mind. Hatha yoga, which most of us know about, is a part of that. It's being able to exercise the body, bring the energy into balance, get ourselves in a condition where we can sit in stillness. Because as we know, it's oftentimes difficult to bring the mind, bring the body into a state of stillness when we're used to being in such a rapid-fire condition all the time. But in yoga, it's called rajasic energy. Rajasic, just constantly bang, 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 bang. Mind is always going, body is always going, always out there. The other is tamasic energy. And tamasic is when we crash and burn after we run on high for so long. And it's depression, it's low energy, it's coming down, it's nowheresville. And many people only alternate between these two states, either highly active state or crash and burn kind of a state. But the yogis say is there's a third state. So if you imagine a linear line like this with the two states, and then like a pyramid, there's a third state. And that's sattvic. And sattvic is that very even, cool, calm state. In fact, it gets so even and cool and calm that yogis who enter into that deepest state have no thoughts at all. They have awareness, but that constant dialogue that's going in most of our brains settles down and comes to a standstill. And with that is the reflection then of all the higher attributes of divine consciousness. And they become realized. They know. They understand it. They see it not through reasoning, not through reading, not through some kind of a cognitive process, but by bringing the cognitive mind down into a great state of stillness. So for many of us, this can sound like, well, is that really possible? Could I really do that? And the answer is yes. Yes. It does take practice. It takes commitment. But yes, we can do that. And it's not learning a philosophy and then spouting the philosophy and saying, well, I believe X, Y, and Z. It's practicing and coming to the realization that X, Y, and Z have shown themselves to be proven true to me. Not through the senses, but through an interior intuition, a realization. And a realization is different than a thought that comes to you or something that you believe into. A realization is a complete and total experience when it comes. It comes to you as every cell of your being says, yes, I know that that's true, I feel that that's true, I absolutely know it. And nobody can shake me from that conviction. Because it's been such a profound experience that I couldn't deny it if I wanted to, and I don't even want to. because I see the superiority of that kind of experience. So when you learn to calm the mind and the body and bring it down into that state, then that becomes a self-revelation. And so the great spiritual masters of the world have had these kind of revelations. Oftentimes those are then written down and it's turned into a religion. And then the religion tells its followers, well, you just accept this by faith. And so this idea of realizing truth somehow gets pushed off to the side, unfortunately. And instead, you memorize, you repeat back an article of belief, an article of faith. That's all right for a beginning, but it's not the ending. And so how we start on that path then is learning some of the ABCs. The basic kind of, okay, we lead basically a moral life. We learn to tell the truth, not to steal. We treat other people as we would like ourselves to be treated. The golden rule. We start leading our life in this way. And Yogananda, my teacher's teacher, is writing a commentary here on the Bhagavad Gita. And that's a very ancient text in India. It's a conversation between Krishna, who represents the higher intelligence and light, and Arjuna, who represents individual will and soul. And so there's this conversation going back and forth, and Arjuna is asking questions, well, how does this all work? What's the truth here, and how does this all work? So Krishna is explaining it to him, and it's a conversation between soul and spirit. So Krishna is speaking and saying, Arjuna, the glutton, or the scanty eater, the person who habitually oversleeps and the one who sleeps too little, none of these find success in yoga. And Yogananda's commentary, unbalanced states are obstacles for the yogi. The beginner should fulfill all normal conditions of a healthful bodily existence. Otherwise, physical troubles will entangle the mind and preclude the deep meditation upon which spiritual progress is dependent. The sadhaka, or the spiritual practitioner, should thus abstain from all excesses, lest his body become an obstruction in the path of divine progress. My guru, Swami Sri Yukteswar, wisely counseled, throw the dog a bone. That is, give the body its due, neither pampering nor abusing it, and then forget the body. In a natural way, as the inner consciousness becomes spiritualized through the success in yoga, the body also becomes spiritualized, and its normal demands gradually diminish. Yoga scriptures enjoin that the aspirant should be a propertarian. That is, he should have a balanced diet, one with sufficient protein, carbohydrates, and vitamins and minerals. But overeating, even of healthful foods, causes disease. Also, when the devotee tries to meditate on a full stomach, he may be conscious of the bodily load and of labored breathing instead of breathless joy, state of superconsciousness. Eating insufficiently, on the other hand, leads to physical and mental weakness. Oversleep dulls the nervous system. Too little sleep produces a tendency to sleep against one's will. Yogis point out that oversleep makes the body lazy. The throat and the nasal passages become filled with phlegm. The devotee should always keep his body free from the accumulation of excessive mucus. If a diet of raw food is found helpful in this regard, the yogi should follow it religiously. Loss of sleep destroys mental freshness. A dull mind cannot concentrate on the joy of the soul within. So Yogananda is writing this back in the 30s, but it sounds very fresh today and very right. Some things we know, but it's an affirmation of that. Krishna continues, he with proper regularity eats, relaxes, works, sleeps, and remains awake will find yoga the destroyer of suffering. The yogi should be temperate in all habits. This stanza points out that the novice yogi should not try to continue unbrokenly in meditation with the exception of a few hours of sleep, thus ignoring the performing of good outward actions. It is unnatural, indeed impossible, for a beginner in the path of yoga to remain in the superconscious state of ecstasy, alternated only by sleep and not by proper activities ordained by God and nature. Reference to regularity in eating, relaxing, working, sleeping, and waking admits of a deeper spiritual interpretation. During the practice of yoga, swallowing air, the ingestion of prana and oxygen, is called astral eating. This eating refers to the breath. The devotee learns to distill life force out of air and therefore to reinforce his supply of prana. His body is gradually freed from the bondage to solid and liquid foods. And there have been yogis who have proved this in their own life, that they've been able to go through long periods without breathing. Some have been buried under the ground. One for a month was buried under the ground. And at that point, he was pulled back up. He was unburied, and he came back into consciousness again, and with full faculties, he continued on with his life. There have been other examples of yogis who don't eat, don't have the need for sleep or eat or any drinking any fluids. And the way that they do this is that they've learned, as we are talking about through the medulla, they've learned to draw on this life energy. When Jesus was wandering around with his disciples, they went begging. And so the disciples went into a town and begged and got some food and came out to share it all. And Jesus said, no, I don't need any. You go ahead and eat. And they said, what? You know, it's food. Here, take it. He says, no, I have a food that you don't know about. Now, he wasn't carrying a secret stash around of travel treats with him, you know. He didn't have a protein bar stuck away in there. He was able to draw on this life force. And as a result of that, he was able to sustain. And you see pictures of Teresa Newman, of Giri Bala, and others who never ate anything for years and years, 30, 40 years, didn't eat. They're plump. Giri Bala, she loved to cook for everybody. But she herself never ate. And she had learned how to draw this life force. Seems impossible to us. And yet these are validated cases where people were not eating at all during that time. And yet they didn't turn into skeletons. They didn't die within a short amount of time. Now, an ordinary person, if any of us tried that, you know, we'd start to waste away into nothing. So it's not something that you can just arbitrarily kind of start to do. You have to learn how to draw that life energy. But you can do it in smaller ways in your life. Say in the afternoon, your energy begins to flag a little bit and you're wearing out. Maybe you would reach for a tea or a coffee or a candy bar or something to get you going and pick you up. And instead of doing that, if you were to sit down for a few minutes, just like what we did earlier, observe the breath, receive. Constantly through the day you've been giving, allow yourself to receive. Receive that life force coming from behind you. Feel as if there's a spiritual wind blowing behind your back. And that you are, your body, your being is a sail, and you're catching that spiritual wind. You're being supported by it. You're being comforted by it. And just try it. Even for 5 minutes, just sit like that. And just receive. And see what the result is. Can you imagine how you would feel after that? And you feel refreshed, you feel revived, you feel relaxed, and you're ready to carry on with your day. So this is very important. And through little ways like this all through the day, you can recharge yourself. You can receive that energy coming in this way. And so many things in life that we do too much of is because we're afraid. And one of the things we do oftentimes is we eat too much. And why do we eat too much? Because there's a subconscious fear, there's not enough. I need energy. There's not enough food in the world. There's just, there's some fear of lack in there. And the more you train the mind to go within and feel from behind you, the more you feel supported, the more you begin to educate and convince the rest of your mind there is enough in this world. I can relax myself. I don't need to be in an anxious state all the time. And through that, you begin to reorient your mind to where your real life force comes from. So many times we reach for food in order to get energy, but then we eat too much and we actually feel fatigued. We feel listless. We eat too much. We don't actually get energized. Where here, from the prana, from behind you, it's calorie free, huh? And it's and it comes to you freely. You don't have to go to a store and buy it. It's there. It's available to you. So it's a wonderful practice to do when you're feeling fatigued and worn out. Just try it. Doesn't mean that you won't need food at all. But if you're relaxed and you're balanced, how much better decisions you'll make about what to eat and how much to eat if you're feeling relaxed in that calm state of mind when you go to eat. So Krishna continues, he who with proper regularity eats, relaxes, works, sleeps, and remains awake will find yoga the destroyer of suffering. That's what yoga means. So, reference to regularity in eating, relaxing, working, sleeping, waking, talks about this prana that comes in. Thus, eating is a reference to breath and to breathing and watching your breath and bringing in the prana in that way. The yogi is advised to be regular in the eating of this air food, what we've been talking about. He should avoid excessive swallowing of air and also too little breathing of air. Excessive or forceful breathing or willful withholding of the breath in the lungs for prolonged periods is harmful. You see, I needed this when I first started reading about yogis because I read about where they could enter into breathlessness. So without being educated around this or taught the right way to do it, I would time myself to see how long I could hold my breath. Not a good idea. Not a good idea. Similarly, the person who unscientifically reduces his breathing takes in insufficient oxygen and thereby poisons his system by too great an accumulation of carbon dioxide in venous blood. See, Master is talking about this now, but now we know through scientific minds that if you get into an anaerobic condition, you actually start hurting your system. If you're aerobic, if you're right in the right zone, you benefit. And if you don't get any exercise at all, your body goes down. So you don't want to be in the too much or the too little. You just want to get into that right zone with it. By regular rhythmic breathing, the yogi learns to distill energy from the proper amount of oxygen present in the naturally inflated lungs during inhalation and to properly expel poisonous carbon dioxide accrued through the decarbonization of blood during normal exhalation. Now, posture here is very important because if our shoulders are rolled forward and we are collapsing down on our lungs, we're not getting full extension of the lungs. So in order to get full lung usage, we lift the sternum here. And when you're sitting, you can imagine yourself kind of planting your buttocks in the chair and then lifting your sternum like this and then just feeling as if there's a string that's lifting your head up. Now your spine, your neck, and your head are all in proper alignment. And then breathe from your stomach. Breathe from your stomach. Most people breathe using about 10% of the top of their lungs here. So when you breathe from your stomach, you breathe. Let your stomach rise up on your inhalation and slightly collapse on your exhalation. Now you're using your diaphragm. Now you're exercising a more complete breath. Now for a complete yogi's breath, if you were to take a full breath, you start out by expanding your stomach. You fill up this part of the lungs. Continue this part of the lungs, the middle part, all the way up to the top. And you can breathe along with me here. Take a complete yogi's breath. Hold. And then exhalation and breathe out. First emptying out the top part, middle part, and then bring the diaphragm all the way up and push all the oxygen out. So let's take two or three yogi's breath here. Extending out your stomach. Hold. And then exhalation. And pull the diaphragm up. Empty out your lungs. Hold, just hold it for a moment. Now breathe in. Breathe out. Squeeze out the last breath. Hold out the breath for a moment. And last time. And exhale. Now return to normal breathing. Just tell me, what do you notice?
What kind of feel? Feel dizzy.
Feel dizzy? Getting some you're getting too much oxygen in the moment. Yeah. So what you can do to help with that is take a little longer rest in between breaths, both the exhalation and the inhalation. And you don't want to do it for a prolonged amount of time. Anybody else?
Very warming.
Very warming. Just took off your jacket. Yeah. Increases circulation. And the prana is also tends to be warming, although it can be cooling as well. Any other observations?
More space in my chest area, just like more space in there.
Yeah.
Lighter.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. What do you experience now?
I feel calm.
Yeah. Yeah. So you get past the dizziness and then a greater sense of calmness. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's a yogic experience right there. And by having that, and yawning is an attempt to get more air. We're trying to get more air when we yawn. So we're unconscious yogis, in a sense. But it's more beneficial to breathe through the nose because we filter the air through the nose in that way. And then we help keep the lungs cleaner that way. So particularly through the inhalation is to breathe in through the nose. And then exhalation can be out through the nose or out through the breath or through the mouth, either way. Okay. So you learn how to get more prana that way, and that can help re-energize you. Regularity and relaxation or recreation signifies that the yogi should breathe neither too heavily nor too scantily, but evenly, as in Kriya Yoga, whereby the breath becomes neutralized or stilled or relaxed. When you watch the breath long enough, and you can start out by doing some of those deeper breaths, especially if you're anxious or you're exhausted, you can do some of the deeper breaths, then just return to a normal breath and watch the breath. There will be moments when the breath will get so quiet and so still in there, you'll realize it's been a little time since you breathed. You actually enter into a breathless state. And then you take a breath and you think, oh, it's been a little bit since I've taken a breath there. And that's a product of the mind and the body coming down into a complete state of stillness. You need have no worry about harming the body because, as we know, if somebody drowns or otherwise can't have oxygen, it can destroy brain cells and it can destroy the body. But your body will automatically breathe if it needs something more. But it can also, when it's completely calm and still like this, sustain itself without breathing. So it's a wonderful practice to be able to do. In the dreamless state of subconscious sleep, the dream subconscious state, and the state of wakefulness, there's three states of consciousness. When you first go to sleep, that first stage, now you go into that sleepless state, really deep sleep. If you get waken up out of that, sometimes it's hard to come back. It's hard to get yourself oriented back. Then you move out of the deep dreamless state, which is really what the samadhi state that yogis go into consciously, is that deep dreamless state. Then you go into the dream, which is really a regurgitation of things that have happened to you and in your life, and the mind is processing it during that time. And then the wakeful state, being awake and awake to the body. Those are the three different states. The ordinary person experiences these three states, which, connected as they are with the body and matter, are collectively called delusive dream state. All three of those are the delusive dream state. The true wakeful state is perceived when the yogi rises above all his subconscious and conscious dream states and is conscious in the ever wakefulness of God. So God here is defined not as some being with a beard in some antiseptic corner of the universe, handing out judgments and smoting and smiting. Not exactly sure what smoting and smiting is, but it doesn't sound too good, whatever that is. But that, in this definition, God is defined as the life and the intelligence of everything that is, of all creation and beyond creation. And that it's possible to unite your mind with the divine mind, that intelligence, that power, through this quieting of the mind and the body. Those are the divine attributes that begin to get reflected in the still waters. And when that happens, you begin to realize the truth of things that have been taught and things that have never been taught, that are new to you, that you've never heard before. And they become clarified and refined through your own consciousness, through contacting this higher state of consciousness. Now, to some people, that sounds like fanciful kind of talking. But this has been proved down through the millenniums, down through centuries and centuries. These experiences have been connected with and then related by different prophets, by different yogis, all the way down through this time. And what came to us through Lari Mahasya and then Swami Sri Yukteswar, Yogananda, and my teacher, Mother Hamilton, was all of these people touched in with that same superconscious state, that same supreme intelligence and power. And as a result, they could verify and say with absolute certainty of their whole being that this is true. This is possible. Now, just because it's rare doesn't mean that it's impossible. And the only reason that it's rare is that people get so consumed with this world, so focused on it, and the habit, we're habituated to this world, that very few people take the time and effort to break away from the delusion of this world and to realize that higher intelligence. So living this kind of balanced life, you eat, you breathe, you live, you have entertainment. You know, it's not a dull life. But in addition to that, you're also making this effort to still and quiet the mind so that you can begin to really access this higher intelligence. And it's not just an occasional kind of thing. It begins to guide you. It begins to direct you in your life. Now, how can you tell that it's coming from a higher intelligence rather than, say, your old subconscious mind? Pretty tricky fellow the mind is, isn't he? And even when we're just trying to do right from wrong, sometimes it's difficult to figure out, am I fooling myself here, or is this really the right thing to be doing? And when you get in touch with this intuitive intelligence, there's a calmness about it. You know, if you see something and you go, boy, I'd like to get that. You know, that new tool or that new piece of clothing or whatever, you know, it just kind of calls to you. You know, you go, Boy, I'm just thinking about that. I really want to get that. It's not calm. You're feeling pulled, you're feeling pushed, you're feeling, yes, 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 that's what I want. If in that moment you could say, okay, well, that's kind of interesting. I would like to have that, but is this the right thing for me to get? And you were to take the time and just breathe like what we are breathing. Get into a calm state away from that desire nature. And say, okay, what's the right thing for me to do here? And you get into a very, very calm state. And then suddenly it just becomes very obvious to you. Yes, I should do that. Or no, that's not really the right thing for me. Years ago, I developed a 24-hour rule. Any major purchase that I'd make, I'd wait at least 24 hours before I made the decision. It's amazing how in 24 hours how things drop off. Oh, it's just really not that important. Boy, at the time, though, you know, if I just got, yes, of course, that's what I want. That's the greatest thing since sliced bread. I'll take that. Maybe two of them. 24 hours later, you know what? It's kind of a lot of money. I don't think that's something I really need. I can let that go. Just by taking that time and letting it clear through the body, by taking the time and getting calm, having a calm mind, and then allowing that intelligence to shine through your mind. It's not your own reasoning. Suddenly it just becomes obvious, clear to you. You know, I know what the right thing to do is here. And you just know it. You feel it inside. Every part of you feels that this is the right thing to do. You know, I was really angry at that person. I wanted to give them a punch. And then I wanted to give them a kick, too, because I'm just so mad at them. You come down in that calm mind and you go, you know what? That person's just not going to get it if I retaliate that way. It's going to hurt me. You know, I'm just not going to go there. I'm just not going to do that. I just know I just need to let this go now. That inner intelligence will guide you and direct you. And when it does, you'll feel an inner calmness and an inner rightness about it. What in yoga is called dharma. Dharma is right action. It's right activity. And when you feel it and you know it, it comes from that deeper place inside of you. And if you could imagine, before any major decision that you make in your life, you would do what I'm describing here. And if you trace back through your life different decisions we've made along the way, oh my gosh, if I'd only done that, how much trouble I would have saved me.
Where were you then?
Exactly. And for me as well, you know, where was I? And to be able to do that and to cultivate that, and in the midst, in the heat of battle, when we have that desire, we have that anger, we have that desire for whatever it is, no. First, I'm going to get into the calm mind. I'm going to calm my mind. And however long that takes, it might take me minutes, it might take me days, might take me hours, might take me weeks. But I'm going to work at this, and I'm not going to take activity on this until I feel that inner assurance that I'm acting with the right motive for the right reasons to get the right results. And you really commit yourself to that. You really work it. Really work it. And that's why this is a path of application. It's applying these things and putting them to work in your life and then testing them out and seeing if what I say isn't true. So it's a testing it out and working it through. But really apply that. And see what the quality of your decisions are from that point on when you have that calm mind. And yes, that great deal may go away on you. It's possible by delaying. But you know what? The price that we pay by being reactive, by just wanting what I want in the moment, regardless, who cares? Well, we care later. We pay a price for that. And so we choose to do and guide our lives differently. And that's leading a balanced life. That's calming your mind, calming your body. It creates a better healthy condition for you. You make better choices. And you're better company for the people who are around you.